Welcome back to episode 149, The Serial Crimes of Rosemary Ndlovu. This is part four of this episode. If you haven't listened to parts one, two, and three, go back and do that now and then come back here. This will be the final part of this episode. There may be additional episodes in the future in which I do interviews, but those will be standalone. Today's episode is brought to you by Dial-A-Bed, South Africa's largest branded bedding retailer. We all know that getting a great night's sleep makes us happier and healthier, so Dial-A-Bed is on a mission to make it as easy as possible for you. Shop at 76 stores nationwide or online at dialabed.co.za. A huge thank you to Dial-A-Bed for supporting True Crime South Africa. In episode three, we left Rosemary Ndlovu just as she'd taken what we hope will be her last victim, her nephew, Brilliant Mashego. And although she was starting to struggle with getting the policies she relied on from her victims paid out because suspicion was starting to build, as we often see with serial killers, Rosemary had no plans to stop. By 2018, Rosemary was struggling financially. With her last two murders not paying off, she'd become severely indebted to loan sharks. All her ill-gotten gains over the years meant she'd been living a life far beyond the means of her police officer's salary, and she was most definitely not going to give that up. It's difficult to say exactly which of Rosemary's murders were committed by her own hand and which were undertaken by hitmen, but it would be an idea she had to have two hitmen take out her sister, Joyce Ndlovu's entire family, that would be her ultimate undoing. When she first met up with the two would-be hitmen, Lakiwe Mkiza and Njabalo Kunene, she'd been very open about her financial difficulties. She was so broke, she told the men, that she needed their help to carry out a hit on credit. She couldn't afford to pay them up front, but as soon as the deed was done, she said there would be plenty of money from the many policies she had on her sister. In March 2018, she told the men that she wanted her sister, Joyce, and Joyce's five young children to be strangled or burned to death. She insisted that no one in the household should be left alive. Initially, the two men thought the police officer might be setting them up. So incredibly horrific was the instruction she was giving. Soon, though, they realized she was being absolutely serious, and she wasn't trying to set them up. The men decided to report the situation to the police. And although this interaction would be a major contributor to the woman's arrest, behind the scenes, one detective had already had his eye on Rosemary Ndlovu for quite some time. Sergeant Keshi Benneth Mabunda had first seen Rosemary in 2015. He'd known about her before that, though. She worked at Tembisa Police Station, and he worked, one jurisdiction over, at Olifantsfontein Police Station. It had been Maurice's murder that had made Sergeant Mabunda think twice about Rosemary. The first time his suspicion of the woman was piqued was when she'd walked into the police station a few days after Maurice's murder with a huge pile of policies. She was there to have them signed off by the IO on Maurice's case. Sergeant Mabunda watched as the IO signed them off and Rosemary left. He found out they were policies only after she'd left the office, and found this incredibly suspicious. He had the investigating officer call her back to make photocopies, which she did. The mass of policies was something Mabunda had never seen. So he started looking into Rosemary and Lovu, and soon found she'd claimed such policies many times before. Sergeant Mabunda wasn't officially assigned to the prior murder cases, but he soon saw that almost nothing had been done with those cases, and in his spare time, he began to look into them, and Rosemary. It was Sergeant Mabunda who had eventually started advising insurance companies not to pay out policies to Rosemary. One company had told Rosemary which police officer had warned them against her, and she'd stormed into his office one day enraged. Mabunda was annoyed that the company had let on to his investigation. He didn't want Rosemary covering her tracks. So as she raged in front of him, he phoned the company and told them that they'd misunderstood his inquiries and they should pay out. Rosemary left his office, a little happier, but as soon as she was gone, he'd called the company back and reversed his instruction. He explained that if Rosemary were to call again, they should tell her that they were investigating internally. While Rosemary being a police officer had undoubtedly helped her to continue with her crimes as long as she had, with Mabunda now on her trail, he realized it was something he had to be very careful with. Rosemary was on the same rank he was, and would therefore have access to all the same information he did. He didn't want her knowing that he'd reopened cases, and that all those cases were now being investigated by him. So he used other officers' names on the files on the system. Sergeant Mabunda was dealing with a very complex set of cases, but he continued to press on. His gut told him that this woman was extremely dangerous, and every day she was on the outside meant another victim was at risk. When the two would-be hitmen Rosemary had attempted to hire walked into a police station and asked to speak with a detective, it was not Mabunda they spoke with initially, but the information was soon passed on to him, and he took control of the situation. Mabunda had no idea who was on Rosemary's side, so there were very few colleagues he trusted with information about the cases. Thankfully, it worked out that the officer the informant spoke to was not feeding information to Rosemary, and within a few days, a sting operation was set up. Up until then, all Mabunda had was a lot of circumstantial evidence, and he hoped that the sting would give him the evidence he needed to finally put handcuffs around Rosemary's wrists. The two informants were instructed to contact Rosemary and tell her that they were not up to committing the murders, but they could introduce her to an experienced hitman from KwaZulu-Natal who would kill Joyce and her five children. Rosemary eagerly agreed, and a meeting was set up. The experienced hitman was, of course, an undercover police officer, and the audio and video from that meeting would become significant evidence against Rosemary. It was arranged that the men would collect Rosemary and she would travel with them to the rural area in which Joyce lived so that Rosemary could point out the woman's house. She wanted to be sure that the hitman killed the right family, of course. During the trip and in now infamous recordings, Rosemary coldly explains to the undercover police officer that the children had to die as well, even though she had no policies on them because they would be witnesses. Joyce's youngest child at the time was just 5 months old. Rosemary made several different suggestions as to how the murders might be made easier, including giving Joyce medication to make her drowsy and, horrifyingly, stuffing socks into the children's mouths so that they didn't scream when the home was set alight. At one point, the group stopped at a petrol station and Rosemary filled a 2-liter bottle with petrol for the hitman to use to start the fire in her sister's house. Although Rosemary would never be charged with any gun crimes, during the video, she also let slip that she'd been stealing guns from Tembisa Police Station for years. She sold them on the side for additional income. Rosemary Ndlovu was arrested later that day. By the time she realized she'd been set up and given orders to have 6 people murdered on video recording, it was too late, and the handcuffs snapped around her wrists. The police entourage that had descended on Bushbuck Ridge then drove Rosemary to Joyce's house, where the officers told the horrified woman that she and her children had narrowly escaped being murdered on the order of her sister. Rosemary Ndlovu's trial was always going to be complex and protracted. The nature of the evidence was detailed, and because so much of the evidence against her was circumstantial, each and every case needed to be presented carefully so that the mountain of proof was clear and unavoidable. Rosemary was charged with 20 different counts. These included 6 charges of murder, as well as several of attempted murder, shockingly including one in which Rosemary was accused of attempting to murder her own mother, Sophie Ndlovu. It would be alleged that Rosemary had hired a hitman to kill her mother, but the plans had gone awry and she'd ultimately shelved them. Rosemary's trial soon became a media spectacle, and the accused seemed to enjoy the attention from photographers. Throughout the trial, different poses and quips came from the woman. Occasionally, she seemed to switch back over to pretending to be angered at her photograph being taken, but ultimately, she switched back and flirted, pulled faces and hammed it up. Rosemary pleaded not guilty to all the charges against her. In evidence, it emerged that she had policies in place for 22 family members in addition to the 6 she was accused of killing. Rosemary explained that she'd taken out the policies because she was one of the few members of her family that worked, and she wanted to ensure that she was providing for her family members as best she could. She claimed that all of the deaths of her loved ones had hurt her deeply, and she most definitely was not involved in their murders. With regard to each of the murders, Rosemary claimed that she'd simply been the loving aunt, sister, or partner, and that she'd done nothing but attempt to assist the victims in life. Prosecutor Rihanna Williams did an excellent job of working with Sergeant Mabunda to present the state's case. In contrast, Rosemary's attorney seemed to be found wanting in his attempts to cross-examine witnesses, often trailing off in questioning and losing track of what point he was attempting to make. Accused persons are not required to take the stand in their own defense, and they seldom do, but Rosemary, perhaps feeling that her attorney had not done the greatest job of presenting her case, did take the stand, and for days, she and prosecutor Rihanna Williams were locked in a battle of will and words. Rosemary had insisted on having an interpreter, despite her speaking English perfectly and having done so in her job for many years. This was believed to be tactical on her part, a way to give her time to think about her answers before she gave them. For the first portion of her cross-examination by Williams, Rosemary was calm and collected, almost coldly discussing the murders of her first few victims. Soon, though, Rosemary began to wail inconsolably when she discussed Maurice's murder. But the woman also seemed capable of switching these deep emotions on and off, precisely when Rihanna Williams asked questions which would have difficult answers. The only witness who testified on Rosemary's behalf was her mother, Sophie. The woman had very little to say, but clarified that her daughter had always been a caring individual, and there was absolutely no way in her mind that she could have been involved in the murders of her family members. It was put to the woman that there had been an occasion when Rosemary had come to her home with a man who was unknown to her, and that this man had stayed behind on instruction of Rosemary. It emerged that one of the would-be hitmen who'd eventually gone to police had also previously been asked by Rosemary to kill her mother. She'd taken the man to Sophie's house and, according to him, given him instructions on how to kill her mother. She then left the man at the house overnight, but he said he couldn't kill such an elderly woman, and the plan had eventually been shelved. Sophie and Ndlovu claimed to have no memory about this incident, but the would-be hitman's testimony would be accepted by the court as correct and true. Throughout the trial, it became clear that many of the witnesses were terrified of Rosemary. Perhaps it was simply a matter of what she was clearly capable of. Maybe there was also an added fear of her involvement with Sangoma's. By late 2021, Rosemary's defense rested, and the judge indicated he was prepared to pass down judgments. Rosemary was found guilty on 19 of the 20 charges against her. The judge found that just one of the charges, a fraud charge, had not been completely proven by the state. Parts of certain charges were also dismissed. These related to the plans to kill Joyce and her children. The judge found that it had been proven that Rosemary was guilty of inciting and planning the deaths of Joyce and her children, but not attempted murder, as there had been no physical attempts made on their lives. In the sentencing phase of the trial, Rosemary's childhood was painted as relatively normal. None of the early years, which had been quite odd to be fair, were discussed. Experts testified that Rosemary was a serial killer and that, in general, serial murderers do not have good prospects for rehabilitation. In November 2021, Rosemary Ndlovu was sentenced to 6 life sentences for the murders plus additional years for the attempted murders, fraud, and other related charges. All terms are to be served concurrently. Even with Rosemary behind bars, though, it became clear that she was still incredibly dangerous. Sergeant Mabunda would later admit that in the early stages of Rosemary's trial, while Rosemary was in the awaiting trial section of prison, he became aware that she was attempting to claim on policies from jail. Her youngest sister, Runny, had passed away in 2018, and of course, Rosemary had policies out on her. Sergeant Mabunda did look into Runny's death and believed that she actually had been sick and died of natural causes. Regardless, he most certainly was not going to have Rosemary getting access to money while she was awaiting trial, so he took the insurance company employee to the prison to show him that Rosemary was incarcerated. The most concerning part of this whole scenario was that Rosemary was still very much in contact with the outside world, and this would not be the last time something like this happened. Sergeant Mabunda had been made aware quite soon after he arrested Rosemary that the woman had put out a hit on him. Rosemary was moved to a solitary cell to cut off contact with other offenders, but she was still regularly found in possession of illegal cell phones. Even after her conviction, this behavior continued, and even recently, Mabunda was once again warned that his life was still in danger. Shortly after Rosemary's conviction, she and another woman were charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Rosemary's co-accused in that case, Nomsa Mudau, was also a police officer, and the charges alleged that the two women had conspired to have a hitman kill Nomsa's husband. Thankfully, the hit was intercepted before it could be carried out. Both pleaded not guilty. As far as I can see, the court case on that crime is still ongoing and yet to be finalized. If I had to go down every single rabbit hole that exists in this case, there would be another three parts. But instead, I highly recommend you go and read Naledi Shange's book, Killer Cop. There are many more crazy stories around Rosemary, like the sister who figured out that she was in danger and disappeared with her husband and is still nowhere to be found today. Or the strange interactions her mother Sophie had with other family members. Sophie Ndlovu is an interesting character. And let's be fair, there's absolutely no evidence that she knew her daughter was committing these crimes. She also was actually an intended victim, although she denies that to this day. Anyone in the family who's spoken to the media about Rosemary has been shunned by Sophie, and the woman continues to believe in her daughter's innocence. At first, I thought that this was just perhaps a mother's difficulty in accepting that her child could have done such horrendous things, but reading Killer Cop and hearing how Sophie had behaved around the deaths of many of these family members, I do have to wonder if there's more to it. I'm not saying I think Sophie was involved or had knowledge, but I don't know. She just seems to share a lot of the cold traits her daughter has, in some ways. Rosemary's crimes and convictions have torn her family apart. There aren't very many family members who believe she's innocent, but it's all become a jumble of rumors and innuendos about who else might have benefited from certain deaths, and maybe if there were other victims. In 2023, Sergeant Mabunda was named the South African Police Service's Detective and Forensic Services Employee of the Year. It's an award he richly deserves and one he almost paid for with his life. He only revealed the death threats he'd received to his wife and son after Rosemary's first trial was complete. He didn't want them to live in fear, but realized it was going to come out sooner or later. Sadly, Rosemary Ndlovu was allowed to continue on because of several different factors. The first being her job as a police officer. Rosemary used the access she had to dockets and knowledge of the system to hamper investigations, and also to ensure that she quickly got her murder cases to the point where she could claim from the policies. We also now know that there were individuals in the police service who knowingly looked the other way when they suspected Rosemary, or even when they had clear evidence of her involvement in crimes. Although it's unfortunate, it's not entirely shocking that police officers would cover for their colleagues. The Blue Shield, as it's colloquially called, happens all over the world. I spoke to an anonymous source who was an ex-police officer for the Rosemary's Hitlist podcast series, who told me he knew of many occasions where police officers would cover up for one another. Even without actual cover-ups, though, Rosemary likely knew very well that very little would be done to investigate many of her victims' deaths. In a country where 84 people are murdered every day, and many more die unnatural deaths, which are not murder, but still have to be investigated, many, many cases slip through the cracks. Rosemary also used her knowledge to structure her crimes in ways that she knew would enable them to be overlooked. During her conversation with the man she thought was a hitman, who was actually an undercover cop, she said that he shouldn't use guns or knives because that would immediately stand out as suspicious in a rural setting. We also know that she used or attempted to use some of the men she'd arrested in her role as a police officer to later commit crimes for her. The position of respect she held as a police officer also helped her to dupe her victims. She was highly respected in her family. Many of her family members still lived in deep poverty, and Rosemary's seeming success and her authority as an officer undoubtedly had many of her victims believing she would never do anything to harm them. She was also the second oldest child in the Ndlovu family. After she murdered the oldest, Audrey, she was the oldest surviving Ndlovu sibling, and we saw how she used this position of power within her family to convince victims that she was just looking out for them. The aspect of poverty within the families who were affected by Rosemary's crimes is also important. In fact, Rosemary said herself that she'd taken out policies on her family because she was terrified of reverting to the position of abject poverty she'd grown up in, and I have no doubt at all that this was one of the few truths she told. I discussed this when I chatted with Gogo Dineo in the Rosemary's Hitlist podcast, as well as psychologist Thabang Tlaka. Thabang is a clinical psychologist who has extensive experience working with individuals, families, and diverse groups of people in various provinces and settings across South Africa. And we discussed how poverty in itself is a form of trauma. And like any other trauma, it affects individuals in different ways. And also, like any other trauma, the vast majority of people who grow up poor will not in any way go out and do the things Rosemary did. And I'm not for a minute saying this is behind her crimes, but, and that's a big but, I do think it is part of the psychology behind her crimes. Rosemary didn't just kill because she wanted money. Yes, she was clearly horribly greedy and desperate to keep up the standard of life she wanted for herself. But behind that aspect, I think, was a deep fear of regressing to her childhood state of poverty. In that state of poverty, she lacked control and power. Or at least, it likely would have felt that way to her. And I have no doubt that the real driver behind these crimes was the power and control she enjoyed from the murders. That was the real core motivator. Far more addictive than money. But really, having money also resulted in an additional layer of power and control. It's so difficult to look at Rosemary's crimes as a serial killer and compare them to someone like Moses Sithole, for instance, because the nature of the crimes are just so different. But I think when you break them down, they aren't really that different after all. A serial killer that commits sexually motivated murders like Moses Sithole did is not committing these murders for sex, any more than Rosemary Ndlovu was committing her murders for money. For him, like her, it's about power and control. Sithole selected his victims quite specifically. He chose women who were vulnerable, often due to unemployment and poverty. Rosemary selected her victims around much of the same criteria. But in addition, She chose those close to her because it was easier for her to cash in on their deaths and control their murders. We know many organized serial killers also have a period before they commit their murders, which is almost as integral psychologically to the murders as the event itself. This is their planning and victim selection period, and many describe it as incredibly thrilling to know that they are setting the victim up and manipulating them. For someone like Sithole, this involved making contact with victims, offering them jobs, and getting them to meet him in or go with him to an isolated location. For Ndlovu, this period involved getting information out of her victims, arranging policies, and setting up the manner in which they would be killed. Although Sithole was obviously far more hands-on in his murders, it's not uncommon for female killers, whether one-off or serial, to involve hitmen in their crimes. But if we include the victims that she was not convicted of, like her children and her first husband, many of these crimes were actually committed by Rosemary's own hand. In fact, the witness testimony from many would-be hitmen in her trial showed that she wasn't terribly successful in arranging other people to kill her victims. Look at Maurice. The first two attempts were hitmen and failed. The third attempt was by her own hand and failed. But we still don't know if that fourth successful attempt was actually her or a hitman. And really, it could have been either. I don't know if a hitman would have stabbed Maurice 80 times. As with Sithole, there were elements of childhood that may have made these individuals feel powerless. In Sithole's case, it was sexual abuse. In Ndlovu's case, it may have been poverty. So really, when you look at the parts on their own, she's not really all that different. And in many ways, she may actually be far more dangerous. I think what really blows my mind about this case is how far ahead Rosemary was planning. She had 28 of her family members insured at one time. In her mind, she was set for life. She was just going to carry on picking them off one by one. All she had to do was make sure she didn't get caught. And who knows what might have happened if Sergeant Mabunda hadn't been working just one police station over at the same time as Rosemary. How many more people would have died? Rosemary has also proven that she is still incredibly dangerous, even though she is behind bars. Considering she still has family members that support her, and DCS just can't seem to keep cell phones out of her hands, who knows what the heck she's still capable of. We saw this with Cecilia Stain too. There were several rumors after she was convicted and incarcerated that she was still threatening people from the inside, and she was proven to have a cell phone in her possession too. And that brings me to the female psychopath aspect of this. Although she doesn't have a clear diagnosis of such, I think it's fair to say that Rosemary Ndlovu undoubtedly shows many traits of psychopathy and would likely rank quite high on the psychopathy checklist if tested. In May, when I attend the Franschhoek Literary Festival, I'm going to be having a conversation with a few true crime authors, including Naledi Shange, around psychopathy and narcissism in murderers, and I definitely want to further discuss and analyze the difference between male and female psychopathic traits. I'll do my best to share that conversation with you in the podcast, but if you can attend in person, I highly recommend it. Something I've been thinking about a lot lately is that the psychopathy checklist, and really so much of the DSM in totality, was built around male subjects. And of course, we know that the genders present differently from a psychological perspective. So, how do we know that the checklist we use to diagnose male psychopaths is really effective with female psychopaths? What if females are being significantly underdiagnosed as a result? I think that is very possible, because female killers in general do not present the same way male killers do. And very often, they have a different experience in the justice system too. Anyway, that's most certainly a topic I've become more interested in while talking about Rosemary, and there'll definitely be more discussion on that in the future. I'm sure I'm not the only one who is horrified that Rosemary managed to weaponize the insurance system in the way she did. And let's face it, she's not the first person, and sadly, likely won't be the last, to kill for insurance money. I was really very disturbed to see how little care seemed to go into the administration of these policies by companies, and in many ways, I actually felt they almost enabled Rosemary. It was very clear that as long as they were getting paid, they didn't really seem to have much concern for the insured person. So if we can at least take something out of this horrific case, perhaps it can be the knowledge that this can happen to any of us, and we need to know how to protect ourselves. I asked Edward Siewa how the average person can ascertain whether they're insured under policies they're not aware of.
Currently, it is possible that people are insured and that they don't know. The question is, where do they go if they want to know what they are insured? There is a company called Astute. Astute in insurance space is a company that has got capability to consolidate the insured. So meaning that upon consent, and you are able to get this from a financial advisor or insurance house where you sign an Astute consent, then through that consent, then one can approach Astute and Astute will be able to check, give me a report of all insurances in my name within different insurance houses. It can't pick up because right now there are burial societies, there are different schemes that are cooking underneath. So it picks up only organizations which are within big insurance companies. Then it can pick them up.
Edward also recommends any family who suffered the loss of a loved one to immediately apply to the Master of the High Court for a letter of authority and open a late estate bank account. This will ensure that any policies that are held on the deceased's name will pay out into that bank account to ensure transparency. Honestly, I could probably carry on about this case for much longer than four parts. There are just so many aspects that make this case interesting, but also incredibly tragic. But there are more than enough resources out there for you to get more coverage on this. Definitely read the book Killer Cop by Naledi Shange. Also listen to the four parts of the Rosemary's Hit List podcast, which you can find by searching for that phrase on the pod app you're using to listen, and watch the Showmax original documentary of the same name. I will likely do more on this case in different ways in the future. I have an interview with another journalist lined up, as well as my chat with Naledi Shange. But for now, I've had more than enough of Rosemary and Lovu, and I'm sure you have as well. I hope that we have honoured the victim's memories by delving into the intricacies of what she did, and most importantly, how we can prevent this from happening again by trying to protect ourselves against illegal insurance coverage. I recognise that there were six legal victims of this killer, But in signing out, I think I would be remiss to not also name some of the other victims who lost their lives. They may not have gotten official legal justice, but I do think their names deserve to be remembered just as much. Hand, Causa. Jaunty, Causa. Audrey Ndlovu. Witness, Khomu. Maurice Mabasa. Makanani Mabasa. Zanele Mota. Willie Mashaba. Brilliant Masheko. And any other victim taken in this horrendous series. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.